to item three, which is the director's report. Director Anderson, I know you've been busy lately, to say the least.
Thanks, Madam Chair. We're going to use some visual aids to go through our report today, so give us just a moment. Madam Chair, Commissioners, friends of the department that joined us here this morning for this commission meeting. As usual, Joe and I are going to go through a kind of a wide variety of topics in an effort to try to bring you up to date on some of the things that we've been working on since we last met. First one is I wanted to update you on the status of our federal funding. We've brought this issue to you on probably over the course of the last three consecutive commission meetings, letting you know of some potential cuts that the department will be facing as a result of congressional action on both the 2014 and 2015 federal fiscal year budgets. Just as a brief reminder, you can see here represented in our pie chart our 2013-15 budget, and you can see that 29% of the revenue that the department receives during this biennium will come from federal funding sources, totaling over $107 million. Also depicted on this slide is kind of the major areas where we receive federal funding. From U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, Pittman-Roberts, Dingell-Johnson are two big pieces, as well as the state wildlife grants. Environmental Protection Agency providing us funding for work, particularly in Puget Sound. Bonneville Power Administration for the Columbia Basin mitigation, variety of fish-related activities associated with that funding source, and then of course NOAA with those accounts that you've become familiar with: Mitchell Act, Pacific Salmon Treaty, Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds, our joint enforcement agreements, and marine mammal under the Prescott grants. One of the things that we have done in the last three biennia is really try to ensure that we have a solid understanding within each general activity category where our funding is coming from. And you have, you may recall that we have developed a four-page color brochure that depicts these activities. We'd be happy to provide you an updated one if that would be helpful. But taking information from that, you can see here that native fish recovery has a variety of activities in it, including hatchery reform, marking of hatchery fish. 40% of those activities are supported by federal dollars. Fisheries management, you can see almost 30%. Our fish production hatchery program, a little over 20%. And you can look across. I won't read all those off to you. You can certainly see ecosystem restoration approaching nearly 60% of our revenue for that activity comes from federal funding sources. In working with our congressional delegation and looking at other, and as well as our federal partners, we have set out these items as our federal priority initiatives. You have seen these before. Some of the Yakima Basin Integrated Plan, you'll recall the Tianaway purchase being a key component of that plan that we were successful in securing along with Department of Natural Resources and our partners from the Yakima Basin Integrated Plan, that group, key legislators, of course, in the conservation community, those partners enabled that to happen. A lot of work yet to go there. Joe will touch briefly on those in his remarks. The Puget Sound Nearshore Estuary Restoration Project, that's the one that's been ongoing for about 10 years. We've got about $20 million invested in that project, $10 million from the state, $10 million from the Corps. There were about 18 key projects, key estuary restoration projects. That list is now down to about 11. But those 11 projects, if we're able to successfully implement those, make up about 80% of the benefits coming from all 18 projects. Of course, the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation Management Act, the one that Commissioner Schmitten referenced here a little bit ago, it's up for reauthorization. Want to track that very closely. Our update in terms of our highlights are that the sequester cuts that have been discussing were removed from the federal budget for both 14 and 15. Those being taken out of those two federal fiscal years lowers our impacts, but they don't eliminate them. The Pittman-Roberts funding continues to increase. You'll recall the revenue comes from sales of firearms and certain firearms and ammunition. And then the new five-year farm bill passed, which has a regional conservation partnership program component and funding, voluntary access program, and habitat improvement program component to that. So those are some highlights, as in good things. Looking at the reductions in federal fiscal year 2013, you can see Mitchell Act has a 6% reduction in operation and facilities, so that's on the production side. Partners for Fish and Wildlife has a 6% reduction in funding coming from the regional fisheries enhancement groups, and then that good old acronym of Pacific Coast Salmon Recreation Restoration Fund has about a $2 million reduction coming to Washington State. I believe that's out of a total of about $23 million. And then looking ahead to 14, there's an added 5% reduction in Mitchell Act, again in that category that includes production. And also a significant reduction in reform funding. You may recall that about 4 years ago, we got about a $10 million add there for reform, helping us with alternative gear development, hatchery reform measures. So that funding has been cut in a significant way. The Pacific Salmon Commission, I've talked to you a little bit about this. We've been able to leverage some carryover and backfill some activities that were lost from other federal funding sources like the anadromous fish grants, which provided funding for our coastal sampling and monitoring programs. We lost that funding in its entirety 2 years ago. We've been able to backfill the revenue to allow that activity to continue from sources within the Pacific Salmon Commission. That source is exhausted. We don't have that to draw on. We are working another strategy. We were on the phone yesterday working on another strategy to try to find an alternative funding source within the Pacific Salmon Commission. And then on the Puget Sound Geographic Funds, this is one that's coming from through EPA, a $5 million reduction that may impact our marine and nearshore projects. You'll recall that Special Assistant Jennifer Kwan is our federal legislative liaison person, and she's been working really, really hard on all of these issues. We did send a funding request letter to the delegation last month, and she made a trip back there in March, received some good support. We've asked for $40.6 million in salmon management. Salmon management, that category includes things like Mitchell Act are in there, and then there's a standalone on the Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Fund of $65 million, which is level funding. The President's budget had a $50 million number there for that activity, and the House had $35 million. So, but the Senate did have $65 million. We have been successful in generating letters that you see there from congressional members to appropriation committees, governor's letters, submitted a joint request, so as well as the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission have supported our efforts. So we're going to, that's kind of the federal overview and update from the information I've provided you in previous presentations. I will be going back to D.C. the end of this month for a week, working primarily on those funding issues. So we're going to continue our aggressive approach to try to minimize to the extent possible the cuts in our federal funding. Joe's going to now take over and talk to you a little bit about our state budget and the results of the supplemental session.
Morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, Commissioners, members of the public. I'm going to touch just briefly on the state budget. I think you're aware that at any given point in time, we're really managing three budgets at the state and federal level. We're closing out last year's budget and looking at how we did. We're putting in play the money that we have in the current budget, and we're planning ahead. So we just closed out the supplemental session, and I briefed you on that in terms of the detail at one of our last meetings. And we are starting to look at the policy direction we got during the supplemental session. We're looking and trying to anticipate federal and local reductions. We're looking at our strategic plan to make sure we're performing and meeting the milestones and objectives there. And looking at the possibility of additional revenue ideas. We're exploring half a dozen different revenue ideas, and all of that with the intent of producing a budget proposal to the governor's office sometime in September. So as we look back at the supplemental session, it was a short session, ended on time for the first time in a long time. Elections are out there, and I think the members were eager to get done and get on with the preparing for elections. We had a very successful operating budget, and I gave you, I believe, in Moses Lake, a copy of our Chief Budget Officer's memo, Owen Rowe, that detailed where funding landed in the supplemental. First time in 20 years, no capital budget. Didn't hurt us. We had two major hatchery-related projects in our capital proposal, but we've got funding to move forward. Actually, sometime I want to brief you on our capital budget, because we've got some pretty incredible things going on the ground, and this public-private partnership is really in place and well and alive, and with the Jobs Now Act. And just really proud of the team we had that's working. The legislature, directors spent lots of time. We've got strong relationships there, and that has really proven to be a good thing for us. Next legislature, we're going to see many of the same dynamics, probably a lot of the same leaders, probably a split between parties. Education funding, the McCleary decision, the need for $5 billion, depending on who you talk to, maybe $5 billion plus increases in K-12 education is just going to drive the whole discussion around budget. And it's very likely that there will be general fund available. So as we think about funding needs, we're real hesitant to even propose general fund. We think the legislature is pretty unlikely to backfill any federal cuts, as the director described, and for a number of reasons. It's a bad precedent. There's a long list of federal budget cuts, and so there's no way they could backfill all of those. And I think that there's some wisdom in keeping some pressure on the federal government in terms of dealing with the impacts that occur at that level. So we are looking hard at the numbers that the director just laid out to try to define impacted activities and trying to anticipate what legislators are planning on doing to deal with the McCleary Supreme Court decision. That's it. In addition to budgeting, in terms of production and getting things done, we are heavily involved with the lean process. And if you'd like a briefing on that, I think this is another area where we're making some great progress. We created a lean transformation office, the LTO. And we have a gentleman by the name of Rob Geddes, who we brought in a couple of years ago. He had worked as a consultant. He had a long military background, great performance manager, and he teams up with Yair Rietsma and all of our program leadership to look at how we can be more efficient in terms of service delivery, how we can save money, apply it to other places. And we've taken on a number of projects at the agency level and within the programs. We worked with DOT to improve our fish barrier removal processes. We have ongoing work to improve our hiring processes, and we are beginning an effort to look at land-related information sharing across programs. We our training staff, it isn't just these two individuals and agency leadership. We're out offering Lean 101 so that, the theory is every individual ought to be looking for efficiencies in how they conduct their work and how they produce the products that we deliver as an agency. And so you can see the training plus the program level projects that are going on. It isn't just agency level work. And some very impressive things in IT, licensing, and the fish program that we've taken on.
So we'll switch gears here. And
Excuse us.
Oh, all right.
Commissioner Smitten.
Director, you probably know this, but back to the federal budget before we leave it. More bad news coming from last week, and specifically NOAA released its budget last Tuesday, I think. Of the seven line offices in NOAA, including Weather Service, Satellites, NOAA Corps, and NIMS, NIMS was the only one to go down approximately $100 million. And I don't know how that's going to sort in their support that they've provided the department, but I'm sure Jennifer has been on top of that, but that was a huge hit. Only line to go down.
Thanks, Commissioner Schmidt. I was aware of that. We do have a meeting with Perry Tom, who's the deputy in charge of operations for the West Coast region, next week to get a better understanding of how that may impact us. So I'll take a few minutes and talk a little bit about North of Falcon. We've had 24 hours or so to reflect back on what happened over the course of the last 5 or 6 days, or 4 or 5 weeks, depending on how you want to look at it. First of all, we had a great team from Department of Fish and Wildlife staff that worked this process this year. We had some folks in new positions, new responsibilities that just did a great job. We had others that continue to improve and just have done a great job. So I was really proud to be a part of that team. We've continually looked for ways to try to improve the co-management part of the process. I think every year it seems like it the last few years have been particularly difficult. Part of that is because of the number of issues that we have had to work through. This year we had an added pressure on us collectively in that our Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan had expired, and so National Marine Fisheries Service will be going through a one-year review of this year's approach using a Section 7 consultation as the tool. They have 15 days from the time the council, the Pacific Council, made its final decision on Wednesday to complete that review in order for those fisheries that were intended to start on May 1 to actually get started. In prior years, particularly last year, we had a couple of issues that were what we call in bracketed language in our letter of agreed to fisheries, which we commonly refer to as the loaf. We didn't have that. If that's a luxury, which I'm not sure it is, but if it is, we didn't have that luxury this year. We had to have everything done, agreed to, and produce a model run that met each and every one of the conservation objectives, or we were not going to get a permit from National Marine Fisheries Service, and the scope of impacts associated with not getting a permit included all of our fisheries from Cape Falcon, Oregon, north along, so our ocean fisheries and our Puget Sound fisheries and all our freshwater fisheries in Puget Sound. That's what was at stake had we not reached an agreement. Our difficult issues that we had were, in no particular order, were with Nisqually, Chinook. The ceiling exploitation rate went from 57% down to 52% this year. So even in the absence, if all things being equal from last year, we needed to cut 5 percentage points off the exploitation rate. Of course, those natural origin fish are distributed through a variety of fisheries, and it's hard to find 5 percentage points of reductions. It doesn't come easy. Puyallup was another one that has a 50% exploitation rate ceiling, and in our modeling when we started on Saturday, it was like at 55. So we had 5 percentage points to go there, or 54, somewhere in there. And then we also had the issue that we worked last year associated with the gear conflict, that is, how do you align the riverbanks with recreational fishers and have a gillnet fishery conducted by the tribes at the same time without having conflict. We came to the conclusion last year that particularly when the peak times of the runs, that frankly you can't do that and you shouldn't think that you can. So we made some closures, some separation to the fisheries, and we separated the river also downstream from the Freeman Road down to the mouth and upstream. So at the end of the day, we did reach an agreement. We are going to replicate the days closed, the separation of the two fisheries that we did last year. That was less than what the tribe had requested, but it is what we ultimately agreed to. Last year, we never did get an agreement on that, but we did this year. Lake Washington was a particularly difficult one. We went into the we had to meet a 20% maximum ceiling exploitation rate for Lake Washington, and we were somewhere around 24 on Saturday, and so a long ways to go. The two tribes are Muckleshoot and Suquamish. The Muckleshoot tribe has not had a directed fishery on Lake Washington Chinook for years. They've had some fishery in Lake Sammamish on Issaquah hatchery fish, which are not in particularly good shape by the time they get to Lake Sammamish. But they don't have that every year. It was kind of the linchpin. We needed to get that one solved before we could really figure out what we had to do on the Squally Puyallup. And then the fourth one was Skokomish. That also has a 50% ceiling exploitation rate. And when we went into the conversations on Saturday, I don't remember exactly where we were, but somewhere around 54. So we had a ways to go there, too. And when you think, 4 percentage points may not sound like much, but when you go trying to find 4 percentage points of a natural origin stock that numbers a little bit more than 200 fish, it's hard to find them. And when you do find them, you generally got to cut a whole lot of other fish in order to get the savings that you're looking for. And we also had some conflict issues in the Skokomish River. You may recall last year we also had a jurisdiction issue associated with could the tribe require recreational fishers to have a tribal permit when fishing in the portion of the river that borders the reservation. So we had and on this one, we didn't get this fishery agreed to until about the third week of July last year. And we had many of the same issues in April this year that we had in April last year. But the luxury, if that's what that was, again, may not be a luxury to wait to work on something that much longer, but we didn't have that. At the end of the day, we got that resolved. We don't have a jurisdiction issue. The tribe moved a portion of their fishery into July, and the reason rationale for that is we're trying to establish a spring Chinook run in the Skokomish River, and hopefully somewhere down the road have that be the primary population. And the fall run used to be a later timed return than what it is now. So we're looking to try to get those fish that are in the early part of that fall run timing removed. And so, but they did make reductions in the later part of their season to make up for that. And they are going to try some alternative gear. They're going to try some beach seines, but not do it in a way that results in conflict with our sport fishery, so we were able to work through that. The other Chinook issue was Lower Columbia River tulies. We have a 41% ceiling exploitation rate on that stock, and we started the week somewhere around 43.5. That's a total exploitation rate, so it includes in-river fisheries, so we had to have some agreement on how we're going to share the impacts inside and out. It also includes impacts to the north of the U.S.-Canada border. There were some increases in the Canadian fisheries this year because of the strong forecast for upriver brights that's pushing a million fish. And so we had some challenges there, but worked through that. Came out with a 40.97 exploitation rate that was in the final package. So looking at Puget Sound, we made some reductions in Area 9 and 10 so that Port Townsend down through past Point No Point and on down past Chill Shoal and down to Alki Point, the south end of Elliott Bay. Those two areas, we made some reductions in the Chinook, marked selective Chinook fisheries in the summer, which will undoubtedly shorten those seasons, probably somewhere around 2 weeks. They're going to start July 16th, but we'll wait and see. We are going to have those as a one-fish limit this year, so trying to get as much time on the water as we can. The other remarkable thing about Puget Sound, or I found it remarkable, is that we converted, as in our effort to reduce our exploitation rates on those Chinook stocks that I mentioned, we added several marked selective fisheries in Area 13, Area 11, Area 7. We'd done that 3 years ago, 4 years ago. We'd have fought about that for days. Not one question. As long as we made the commitment for sampling and monitoring, not one question.
Wow.
Now, those come with a cost of somewhere around $100,000 in sampling and monitoring expenses. And we were careful to make sure we had identified a funding source for those. But that was a remark. The silence was deafening. I don't know if any... I never brought it up. I never said anything about it during the process about I was pleasantly surprised that was okay. So we have some reductions in Puget Sound, but overall I think we'll have a number of good fishing opportunities in Puget Sound. Thompson Coho, that's a 10% exploitation rate ceiling. We were at 11.92 when we started on Saturday, so we had a ways to go there too. There were some reductions in the ocean quotas, although not big, and some reductions in the treaty troll quotas for coho. And we also converted three days in the last 2 weeks of September in Area 5 from a non-selective to a selective fishery to find those savings. And there was also, we also closed Hales Pass, which is by Lummi Island. In the commercial fishery, we're able to save some there. And there was also some modifications made in the treaty 7-7A net fishery that got us to the 10.0. Ocean quotas, so they're going to be good. 220,000 coho overall. And we have another marked selective fishery in the ocean that's starting earlier this year. It's going to start on May 31st in all areas. It's going to run for 2 weeks and then transition to the all species fishery. The Chinook quota is 111,500 with 116,000 marked selective fishery equivalent. So what that means is we have a 9,000 quota on our marked selective fishery in the ocean. That takes 4,500 fish as non-selective to get there. So that's when you hear the 111.5, you add 4,500 to create the 9,000, and you get to 116. That's where those numbers come from. On Grace Harbor and Willapa Bay, we do have the luxury to stretch that process out. I don't know that anyone thinks it is a luxury, but we're not bound by that same constraint from an ESA permit perspective. I know Mr. Mitby and Mr. Lake raised some questions here during open public comment. This issue is on the agenda for the Fish Committee on, and so we're going to be giving them an update on Grace Harbor and Willapa Bay. We did spend quite a bit of time talking with the tribe, with Quinault Indian Nation. We have their inputs. They are managing to achieve the overall spawning escapement goal for fall Chinook. I'm gonna trip on that. I think it's 13,533. I think, but so I'm close. So our policy had us when we were at the level that we are that. We constrain the non-treaty impacts to not more than, I believe it's 5%. And so we didn't use all of the non-Indian impact share by imposing that additional conservation approach or I guess buffer might be a way to characterize that. They set, and we gave them our schedule, and then they based their schedule on attainment of that 13,500 and some change goal. So even though we designed our fishery around the policy, we didn't get those savings because the Quinaults were managing for the aggregate spawning and escapement goal. And so those fish weren't left on the table, if you will. And then there's also the issue that Mr. Mitby brought up about hump tulips. So I'm not going to go into any more detail about that. I'll let that conversation take place in the Fish Committee tonight. Willapa Bay, we, in our assessment, we noted that at a 30% exploitation rate, so it isn't to be confused with a harvest rate, it's an exploitation rate on the ocean escapement of Willapa Bay Falls Chinook. And we were seeing our escapement numbers of natural origin fish decline using that strategy. And so we modified the ceiling exploitation rate from 30 down to 20% to try to reverse that trend. And we also put some additional constraints to try to enhance our goal of establishing a self-sustaining population of natural origin fish in Nacelle. So that lower exploitation rate ceiling or allowance to craft fisheries around hatchery fish was more constraining, and there's been some reluctance to buy into that lower exploitation rate. I guess I would characterize it that way. Lastly, is the Columbia River. We have some really strong returns of Chinook and Coho, as you know. And so when you go to model the fisheries and the expectation for catch, given that you have a much higher number of fish entering the river, you're modeling a much higher catch for the same time frame than what you did last year with lower forecast projected. As a result, While some would think that we would have a lot more time on the water with higher run sizes, what we find is that we don't. We have about, don't hold me to the exact number, but we have very comparable time on the water, but with much higher catches. And so I think when people, and of course we're implementing the policy, 70% for recreational on Lower Columbia River tules, and that's really is the driver. I think there's some disappointment that the season lengths are not longer than what they're modeled out to be. So there is that issue out there. We are primarily having our commercial fisheries take place above the Lewis River to stay away from tule impacts. They do have an allowance of tule impacts, but we are trying to focus their fishery again above the Lewis where we can get at greater numbers of upriver brights and coho absent impacts on the lower river fish. So that's my best effort to try to summarize what happened in the last 6 weeks, for me in the last 6 days, and some of the challenges that we faced. We had a core group of constituents, stakeholders, advisors that stuck with us right to the bitter end. And they were very helpful to us, particularly in the last few days when we were trying to figure out where to find a very few fish. We were at 52.99 on Lake Washington on Wednesday morning. But they just rolled up their sleeves. There was no complaining about the situation. We said, here's where we got to go. Help us design changes in the fisheries that will get us there. We gave them all the charts and data and where the impacts were. And they just did a great job of responding, as did our ocean folks, when we had Thompson problems and Lower River Tule problems, and had a few problems with Queets Coho. They too, all the way through the process, just stepped up and had a can-do kind of attitude that was really impressive and very, very helpful. So, again, just I'll just close on this one by. I think I said this on Sunday to our group that I thought this was the toughest North of Falcon that I'd experienced. And I think that, you know, in part is brought about by the fact that we had this, you had to have total agreement by the time Wednesday rolled around, or your entire fishery was going to be at risk. That put more pressure on us on the process, I think. And as I left there and drove home, I began to question whether my assessment that it was the toughest one I'd ever done was true. But I do think it ranked in the top 4 or 5 anyway. We did it, and it's an imperfect process, and no matter how hard we try to improve it, it's always going to be imperfect. It's going to be like I don't know that I want to compare it to our governance system in the United States or in the state. It has lots of warts and doesn't work very well sometimes, but until someone comes up with something better, it's what we've got. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking for ways to improve it, but to think it's ever going to go easy is an unrealistic expectation. So if that's where you think you're going to get it, I would suggest you use your time in another way. Okay, so I would, if there's, I'm going to move on now. If I don't, I, we appreciated having Commissioner Carpenter and Mankin there with us for some of the way, because one of, though I guess maybe I wasn't the last thing, this is the last thing. How do you go back? How do you come here? How do our stakeholders go back to their constituencies and try to tell you, describe to you what happened with any, that gives it any sense of realism or justice to what happened? I don't know how to explain. I can't put into words what we've just been through. I feel what we've just been through. From the moment you get that last agreement, after being just on a adrenaline high for 6 days, the drop, the fall is unlike any other fall I've ever experienced, because you're up here, and when the last agreement's reached, you just I crash. I don't know what anybody else does. So I'll leave it there. And I'm going to move on unless one of the commissioners has any.
Commissioner Carpenter has to say something.
I just wanted to add a little bit to what the director said, and ditto most all of it, certainly, if not all of it. One of the things that I've been trying to do is to try and get more constituent participation. And this year I felt like it went the other direction, frankly. I mean, we ended up in Vancouver with not very many stakeholders there. And I think the one common denominator, if you look around the North of Falcon process, is from 1 year to the next, the only thing I can tell you with certainty is that everybody there is 1 year older. There's nothing else that I see change. It's the same older faces. But I want to end this, my comments with this. If it was not for Director Anderson's leadership and his unbelievable stamina, we talked one morning, he said, well, at 2 o'clock I woke up and I was thinking about this. And then at 3:30 I woke up and I thought, no, that wasn't right, I was thinking about this. And then at 4:30 I thought, maybe I should do it this way, and then hell with it, I just got up. You know, without his leadership, we wouldn't have got there, and I just can't emphasize that enough. Imperfect system, great leadership. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Mankin?
Yeah, I obviously can't but concur with Commissioner Carpenter, but there was one other thing, too, that I thought was very positive about it. We had an enforcement meeting with our co-managers to talk about enforcement, and there have been some pretty tricky issues there over the years, and my feeling was that there was a much more positive outlook on enforcement and some of the problems that we've been having for a number of years. I don't know if you want to talk about that or not, but
I think Deputy Chief Sensi has been working his tail off at regional levels, working with individual and groups of tribes. That's been paying off. You can see the dividends really paying off. Normally, those tribes that maybe we don't have as good of, or that we have good things going on, are silent in those meetings, and they weren't this time. So enforcement's still a big issue for the tribes, no doubt, and us, and we will continue to work on it, but I thought it was probably the best meeting that we've had with the tribes on the agenda item of enforcement that we've had, so it's evident to me we're making some good progress.
Yeah, I think there, Commissioner Carpenter and I have been involved in two of those enforcement meetings, and I thought that the complexion of this one this time was quite different, and our co-managers were, there was definitely evidence that our co-managers were with us on on some of the issues, not all for sure, but some of them.
Okay, here we go. Wanted to talk a little bit about Puget Sound Steelhead. We've, of course, been talking about this, dealing with this issue. The Wild Fish Conservancy issued a 60-day notice of intent to sue. That 60-day period, if my math was right, ran out on April 7th. Prior to that, on April 4th, we sent a letter to Wild Fish Conservancy notifying them that we were going to withhold the releases from the hatcheries in question until such time we either had an HPA that was approved or we had reached agreement with them. They have moved forward with the filing of a lawsuit, and I think officially that was done today, but I'm not certain of that, but I believe that's correct. One of the issues was the whole hatchery genetic management plans, the HGMPs. I forgot the M, sorry, on the slide. And we had submitted HGMPs for these facilities back in 2005. The purpose of those HGMPs at that time was in response to the listing of Puget Sound Chinook. So we needed to have HGMPs approved by National Marine Fisheries Service to indicate and conclude that our steelhead hatcheries were not impeding recovery of Chinook salmon. Unfortunately, those were never acted upon, and so they've been there since 2005 with no action. There still remains the possibility of Wild Fish Conservancy filing a preliminary injunction motion to enjoin us from releasing these fish that we've already said that we are not going to release unless one of those two things happen. We've continued to have discussions with the plaintiffs as recent as yesterday. We've also had an opportunity to do some follow-up tribal coordination consultation because many of these hatchery systems, this hatchery production are in watersheds where there's a tribal interest. These are the systems and the releases that are, I characterized at risk. You can see Nooksack, Skagit, Stillaguamish, Snohomish, the Green and Dungeness with the associated production. These fish are on hand, literally ready to be released within the next few weeks. We have talked about what to do with these fish. Generally, we're looking at holding them for a longer period of time and then releasing them into freshwater areas, to enclosed freshwater areas, impounded freshwater areas where we might be able to offer some fishing opportunity on them. We've also been working hard on finalizing and resubmitting revised HGMPs. They have all been submitted except the Skagit, and I met with the Skagit tribes on this matter in Vancouver day before yesterday, and I expect that one to be completed today. The wherewithal of National Marine Fisheries Service to do the reviews of those and provide us a response is a lengthier process than the time that we have relative to the fish. But again, we are talking with the plaintiffs. We're looking. There's been some settlement discussions, but no face-to-face, no at-the-table discussions, but some discussions about what are the potential parameters around a settlement, but again, have not engaged in any discussions yet. So I'm going to really change the subject and go to Hufrat. You want to do this? Good. It's all yours, man.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Yeah.
We wanted to, we know that the Wildlife Program, Assistant Director Pamplin briefed the commission in full, and so I'm not going to go through all of that again. Just wanted to assure you that we're spending a lot of time and energy, and we're taking this very seriously. We do feel like we're zeroing in on the cause. What you do about it is a tougher set of questions, and I think we went through that before. But after looking at the potential cause via a lot of different ways, radiology, parasitology, bacteriology, chemical deficiencies, et cetera, we believe that there's a microbiological cause, and as you heard, we've contracted with labs across the world who have expertise in the types of diseases that cause ungulates to have these problems with their hooves, and we're zeroing in on bacteria called treponema. And you know, trying to fine tune the research around that, and discuss that with the public, very extensive public effort. I think we've had three meetings with our public advisory group so far. We have two more next week in Vancouver and in Chehalis. In addition to that, county commissioners in Wakayakum and Cowlitz counties held meetings of their own where we were front and center in terms of walking them through the research that's occurred and what we've learned about this particular species, treponema. And we also have a technical advisory group that's made up of all kinds of scientific experts from around the U.S., and I mentioned the Hoof Disease Public Working Group. So just wanted to make sure you all were aware that this is still very much front and center for us. It's going to be very hard to deal with in terms of, you know, now that we think we know, what do we do next? And the challenges around managing it and management options will be receiving a lot of our attention. Next slide, please, Mr. Director.
That's it, ma'am. I just gave you the next one.
Okay. Okay, then I wanted to touch on Wanapum. Wanapum Dam. So this is a picture of Wanapum Dam, and I don't know if you can read the kind of fuzzy the text underneath the picture, but what we learned several weeks ago was there was a crack right in this section of the dam, the fourth spillway from the left. And it was noticed, I have a picture that I didn't include. There was a worker walking along the top of the dam, and the rail actually took a bend. Mm-hmm. And they found a two-inch crack that went vertically about 65 feet down. And that caused them to invoke the emergency response plan and draw down the water. They drew it down to somewhere 20 to 30 feet below the normal low. You know, these dams on the Columbia River are a very dynamic system. And for hydroelectric reasons, power generation reasons, or flood control or salmon passage, they're constantly fluctuating over the course of a week, even sometimes a day. So they took the water down to relieve the pressure. That two-inch wide gap shrunk to a one-inch gap. The pool level in the next dam upstream, Rock Island, was also lowered to accommodate river system storage needs. We're dealing with spring runoff, and to also aid in the management of the Wanapum Dam. So we have The pools behind two of these dams lowered significantly, and they're doing a lot of exploratory work on Wanapum to try and determine what caused this. Early indications indicate there may have been some structural deficiencies. I won't say structural deficiencies, but some deficiencies in the concrete itself. And it doesn't look like it was an earthquake or some other kind of catastrophic issue. But you can see what's happened as a result of that drawdown. You have vast stretches of land that's exposed, and there are significant safety and cultural resource protection issues. People got curious and wanted to go out and explore, and so we've had our enforcement officers, the Grant PUD personnel, a number of other folks out there trying to keep people off of those exposed areas and away from those cultural resources. Fish passage is an issue, as for instance on the Wanapum with the drawdown, they weren't able to keep water flowing through the fish ladder, and so to deal with that with the salmon we expect to be returning sort of as we speak and into the near future, they're talking about putting pumping water into the top of the fish ladder so the fish can make it up the ladder over the dam, and then some sort of delivery system into the water. They're also looking at a trap and truck option. And Fish Committee, Jeff Korth, our regional fish biologist from Region 2, will be giving you a lot more detail at the Fish Committee meeting tonight. But that's a huge issue. Another issue that we've been spending a lot of time on are irrigators and orchards. We've got cherry trees, apple trees, all of those orchards are coming into bloom. Huge dollars around them. And water is used not just for irrigation, and once they come into bloom, they do need irrigation, but also for frost protection. So we have hundreds of acres of orchards worth, I don't know how much, but a lot of money that are in a very vulnerable state right now. In the Wanapum Pool, we believe there's somewhere around 10 to 12 irrigator diversions that are out of the water right now with the drawdown. In the Rock Island Pool, there's up to 100 diversions. We don't think there's that many that are above the water line, but we think there's probably 20 or 30. So we've been scrambling to try and get our HPA emergency permits out. We've been scrambling to provide technical assistance because these new extended diversions have to have screens that are ESA protective. We've been working with the Conservation District, with the counties, with our counterparts at the Corps of Engineers. We had a recent issue with the Corps, and we're working through that in terms of the ability to, in a timely way, get the necessary permits in place. We're in a good spot, but we're working with the Corps as they make their evaluations on these. And then another big issue is just that we expect to see more of as the weather heats up is just access. There's no way you can put a boat in at Vantage, for instance, at the boat ramp there. That boat ramp is high and dry. The only river access in either of those pools is one on the Rock Island pool. So people who typically would pull off of I-90 and go down and jump in the water or launch their boats, go water skiing, fishing, that's not going to happen very easily. So I'm going to switch to, this is going to make Assistant Director Pamplin very nervous because I'm going to talk about Mazama pocket gophers and a recent listing. So we've been working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for over a decade on species that are related to the prairie ecosystem. And one of those is the Mazama pocket gopher. And looking at ways to enhance recovery of those species. Those populations have been lost or degraded from development, from loss of habitat over the years. And we're on the list for potential listing. And as of this last week, the federal government, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, did list them as threatened. On April 9th. They listed four subspecies, Olympia, Roy, Tenino, and Yelm. They also designated 1,600 acres in Thurston County as critical habitat for the protection of those three of those four subspecies. Originally, we were talking around over 9,000 acres as potentially being designated. That's been reduced as a result of a harder look and a lot of public input. In that determination, they included a 4D rule to promote maintenance or restoration of open habitat. So this rule essentially gives direction to landowners about how you would conduct certain activities in a way that would minimize take or minimize impacts to this now threatened species. There was direction in terms of ag and ranch land activities, things like grazing and the depth of planting, airport maintenance, noxious weed and invasive plant controls, and single-family residential landowner parcels. There's a discussion in the rule about how large your dog kennel can be, or how you should think about sizing and placing foundations for buildings and homes. So we're working closely with the Fish and Wildlife Service on next steps. We're looking at designing a prairie reserve for landscape-level conservation, trying to identify our role in this habitat conservation plan, and a lot of outreach and communication regarding the listing. There's a lot of energy in South Thurston County around this.
I will just... Before I go on to the next one here, we've been working really hard with the local government, school districts, Port of Olympia on the pocket gopher issue, and along with interests in the land development, and it's been a really difficult issue for them because they, for example, the Tumwater School District, the properties that they have that they had planned to use for expansion as a result of the growth of their student population are not available. And so there are a lot of really big pieces here along with the Port of Olympia and the airport, large part of the prairie habitat out in that area. So we're going to switch here to the Oso landslide. Just wanted you to be aware of how many Fish and Wildlife staff are involved with this operation, just under 50 people. We've had people there, as you can see, from the enforcement program, our wildlife program, fish program, and our capital assets management program and habitat program all involved. I went up and visited the site a week ago Monday, was able to visit with a few of our employees that are engaged with the rescue and recovery effort. We had a number of assets, human assets, equipment assets, our rescue team, our whitewater rescue team. That's Highway 530. It's really difficult to put into words or even for pictures to adequately capture the devastation that occurred. Human impact of those who were lost and the human impact on those that are trying to deal with this tragedy and recover those that were lost, as well as they come across personal belongings,
retaining those, getting those to a central point, trying to reconnect the people whose personal belongings that they are with those individuals. These Marsh Master vehicles that you see here were, we used those for Spartina control, and so we took those vehicles up there, and in the particularly in the initial stages, they were the only vehicle that was able to get out on the landscape and actually get out there and help with the initial rescue efforts. We also brought up one of our airboats, but I don't think it proved to be useful because of the terrain. Those vehicles are amphibious, so that you can, and they have a really wide track, as you can see, enables rescuers to move about the devastation and the topography there to try and rescue or recover individuals that were caught in it. The entire community, as I'm sure everyone has seen from the pictures on television in particular, is gone. The wave of matter that came across the valley was, you could see where it was almost, it was like a wave. It went up the other side and then came back with a lot of destruction. I mean, there was enough force in the material as it came back. I saw a pickup tree wrapped around a tree on the opposite side you would have thought it would have been. The sanitary conditions are undescribable that they're working in because of septic systems and all of those kinds of things that were just blown apart. I could see the stress on the faces of the people that were working there, trying to put their best effort forward to help this community. I thought I'd been in some mud in my life, but the mud that is here is indescribable. We had our chaplain there, one of the staff that we had there as well. So I wanted you to be aware of the support that this agency has been trying to give and to try to be a part of responding to that crisis. On to wolves. I think you'll recall in March we had this issue where we had a domestic dog who had taken up with a couple of wolves, and we became concerned that the activities and interactions might lead to some creation of first-generation hybrids, which we did not want to have happen. We consulted with a variety of experts internally and externally, along with some of our partners on our wolf advisory group, and ended up capturing and spaying the female wolf on March 8th. And then we released the animal back into the wild the next day in the same area, and she's collared and appears to be doing fine. We also provided some additional comments to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposal to delist, and it was not a statement of position. It wasn't a restating or a recharacterization of position. It just provided the additional information that came out of our winter surveys and updates to add to the information that they have. The Wolf Advisory Group met on May 20th, and one of the issues that they focused on was the protocols for lethal removal. You'll recall in, must have been February, given that I wasn't there in March, and I remember it, so it had to be in February, that we had the issue associated with the definition of if you have two or more depredations that you could consider lethal removal, whereas the protocols had a higher level of 3 to 4 animals and a lot of other conditions that went into and were precursors to considering lethal removal. I think they worked. I can't say this with certainty that everybody is okay with where they ended up, but I know they worked through that issue. They did some work to the flow chart. And there is, I think, more comfort with where we ended up in that the protocols and now that definition now doesn't appear to be in conflict with the protocols. But I don't want to speak. I have not talked with any of the individual advisors, and I don't want to try to represent that they're okay. But they, my feedback that I got from wildlife staff was that they thought they'd made a lot of progress. We also had a couple of scientists, including John Pierce, look at our actual growth rates compared to what we were projecting when the Wolf Conservation Management Plan was approved, and I believe the rate is around 39% annual growth rate, which is about what we had projected. So if you extrapolate that out, you could have a point in time in 2021 where we had achieved our recovery goals, but obviously I believe what occurred in Idaho and Montana was that there was a pretty, the growth rate was higher initially and it leveled off, so we'll see. There's some research programs being discussed with WSU Wolf Research staff and outreach staff, Conservation Northwest. So there's some work going on there. And then this piece about establishing a carcass disposal site, we're looking at placing one at the Sherman Creek Wildlife Management Area, and a central location where livestock operators could dispose of carcasses. They could be composted. The site design and cost estimates are being completed. And as soon as the frost conditions are passed, we expect construction to start, and we want to try to have it operational this year. And, of course, we have the Lowland Lakes Trout Opener on the 26th. We've got 16.5 million trout out there, and which includes Kokanee and hundreds of lakes. We've got a good representation of jumbos and triploids, and crews have been out stocking lakes since March. And so we want to encourage everybody to partake in that activity. And if you want to donate something in addition to your license fee to us, we'd appreciate that. And then on a more operational note, we're also making progress on the Vancouver office move. You'll recall that they're in kind of the east part of Vancouver in a building that is no longer adequate to meet our needs. We're housed, it's a jointly co-located with Department of Ecology. We did receive funding from the legislature. Negotiations are in progress, and we have a location of the new facility that's awaiting a little bit more conversation with OFM before we're going to be in a position where we can share that. But we're optimistic that we're actually going to make this happen after a decade of working on it. So that, I know we're over time. Apologize for that. But had a number of, there's been a lot of activity going on. There's been a number of difficult issues that we've been engaged in that we, I say we, the big we, all of us here in the department. I touched on some of them. There are others that I didn't. So, but wanted to give you a sense of some of the high priority, difficult issues that we've been working.
Thank you so much. Any questions? I know we are running a little behind, but does anyone, Commissioner Holtzmiller?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, and I, whether this is an appropriate time or not, just touch on our January 22nd meeting.
I think many of you are aware of the circumstances that we find ourselves in other areas of the state that in looking at land acquisitions or conservation easements and the impact that has on local economies and communities, that the importance of coordinating and being on the same page with the community is of paramount importance. And we've been struggling to do that in some places. We had some good outcomes in some, but some difficulties in other areas. And you're all aware that we've had this 4-0 ranch purchase going on in phases in Assotin County. There's been discussion about potential other acquisitions or conservation easements in Assotin County. Residents, community members, local community or local governments have indicated concern about where we're going and are we really together on this? I took the opportunity to go over to Clarkston here a month ago or so, maybe a little longer than that, and had a chance to sit down with Commissioner Shin and the county commissioner and Commissioner Holtzmiller. And Steve Pizanger and I did, and we talked about let us pause here for a moment or for some time, and let's see if we can get together and the right group of people and talk about, you know, what we have now, how we are maintaining it, what uses it's being put to, and what benefits it has from a Habitat for Fish and Wildlife perspective, and discuss where we're going from here. Are we at the end? Are there other things that we can do to enhance, both from a community perspective as well as an agency perspective, our mission as well as the community goals? So let's see if we can't do this together rather than having the community to react to individual projects or acquisitions. And so we committed to each other to give our best effort at this. And so our first meeting with our group is on April 22nd over in Clarkston, and so I'm really looking forward to that and hearing from the community and allowing us the opportunity to share with them our values and what our objectives are, and then hopefully get us to a point where we have an agreement on how to move forward. And what that looks like, and make sure that how we move forward meets the community's objectives as well as ours. So that's my best effort to try to respond to that question. But Steve Pazanga and I and others will be there for that. And I think from every all indications I've heard, they've got a really good community, a group that's going to get together with us. And so looking forward to doing that.
Great. Thank you. Any other topics? Let me just make one comment. I was very moved by your description and the Oso landslide aftermath. So thank you for that. Thank you for going up there. I want to express some appreciation to the enforcement staff and all of our other staff that's been working to help that community. That reflects very well on our department, I think. And, of course, your North of Falcon presentation's already been commented on about the hard work. Send our appreciation to all the staff that work so hard. We know those are incredibly long, difficult, intense days, starting at sometimes 6 in the morning and not ending until past 10 at night. Excuse me. So express our appreciation again for that. And one other comment. Deputy Director Storr brought up the lean process and the strategic planning process that we go through. And it seems to me that each new governor brings a slightly different slant to that drive for greater government efficiency, accountability, and sense of responsibility for the stewardship of the taxpayer dollars. And I think this commission supports that enthusiastically. We've seen some changes in the approach that's been taken. But I wouldn't want to lose the lessons that we learned when we went through the Burke report scrutiny. I think we're well beyond the difficulties in our administration of capital budgets that were recognized in the Burke report as leading to some serious problems and unhappiness of a level that we never want to experience again with the legislature. And one of the lessons that was drawn in the Burke report was that this commission, our commission, needs to be held accountable too for our role in making sure that the department is being held accountable. So you brought up the idea of a discussion, a briefing on the lean and the LTO approach. Yes, please, let's keep up that pattern, that practice of having a report at least once a year that reminds the commission of its responsibilities. Deputy Director Storr.
Madam Chair, and you know, that could include the capital program, the Burke report from 7 years ago now, as well as the lean piece, maybe some kind of combined.
Right, yeah. And the Burke report told this commission, for all those who were, and most of you were not on the commission when that was drafted. One of the blames assigned was that this commission was not doing its part in asking for that kind of scrutiny of our budgets, mostly the capital budget. But since then, I think we've done a much, much better job. And I think the success in sessions in the legislature are a reflection of the greater happiness level in terms of our administration. So thanks for that. Didn't want to say, please do schedule that. Okay. We're ready for break then. So let's